Welcome to Poetic Principles, sort of the last one of this year anyway. And this evening we have three wonderful writers who I've known through the VCU MFA program. And it will just prove to you what an absolutely terrific MFA program it is. And since many of you here went through it, I'm sure you believe in that one too. But our readers this evening are Paula Champa, who writes fiction, Amelia Phillips, whose first book of poetry just came out this winter, and Joshua Poteet, who actually makes his home in Richmond and who has published a couple of books of poems and Work on Another and chapbooks and various and sundry other things. Paula's novel that was just published this winter is The Afterlife of Emerson Tang, and Amelia Phillips, her book is Signaletics, which was published by the University of Akron Press. And she has been a fellow and scholar at various and sundry things, and because I'll give it a plug, she's also on the staff of the Sewanee Writers Conference. And Josh Poteet, who lives here in town, who has a day job with the Martin Agency. He also makes very interesting art that has featured Gabriel, the leader of slave revolt here many, many years ago, and his poems are also in that story. And they're all really good. They're coming along and making a name for themselves in the world of poetry and fiction, though they've always had a name here. So we'll start with Paula.
Thank you, Mary. I just wanted to say before I start reading that it's really lovely to be in Richmond. I was here a few weeks ago, and to be here again tonight, it's such a treat. I've received so much support from this community over the years, and I just want to especially thank Mary Flynn and Josh for setting up this reading tonight. And I also want to thank two writers, Darren Morris and Mary Boies, who both reviewed the current book, and it really meant a lot to me, and I appreciate the support. I actually did my first reading ever as a writer with Josh many years ago at VCU in Richmond, so it's really lovely to be here tonight and to get to hear some of his new work. So I'm going to read two short sections tonight. I just wanted to introduce the sections a little bit each time because it's helpful to have some context for this book. It's called The Afterlife of Emerson Tang, and the book is the story of four strangers whose lives become intertwined in the search to reunite the engine and the body of a vintage car. Each one of the four characters is dealing with some kind of loss. It isn't necessarily grief, although that is one of the themes, but there's romantic loss, personal setbacks of various kinds, professional setbacks. And so the car has special meaning to each one of them related to their history. And as they're searching, really racing one another to put the car back together, they're really trying to make their own lives whole again. The title character, Emerson Tang, is a young man, and he's a bit of an eccentric. He has a terminal illness, and he's spent his time, he knows he's dying, and he spent some time collecting photographs of modernist architectural buildings because he's very progressive and he's interested in these ideas. As he's preparing his estate for his passing, an older woman, a French artist, appears in his life, and she tries to buy a car from him that he owns. It's the car in question. And you don't know why he has it, you don't know why she wants it, but he refuses to sell it to her, even though he's giving away everything that he owns. He won't release this car. And so in this first passage, we meet the book's narrator named Bethany Corvid, and she is an archivist. She works for Emerson, taking care of this collection I spoke of, but she's become his caretaker. And this is where the book opens. This is about a seven-minute piece. I am a woman with no fingerprints, no patterned ridges to leave a trace of myself in a waxy coating of furniture polish, nothing to press into an ink pad or scan with a computer eye. I am undetectable, a model of discretion, and I am human. At least I was during the time in question, with a belly button attesting to my birth 30 years earlier, a first and last name, Bethany Corvid, and 10 fingers that were otherwise so ordinary as to pass without notice. But the ends. This was where the erosion of the self materialized, and if the ends of my fingers lacked the usual loops, whorls, and arches, my other human qualities must have amounted to nearly as complete a blankness. That's how it felt, anyway, when the whole business started with the car. I didn't know about my missing fingerprints then. I only sensed the blankness on the inside. Maybe you know what I mean. When someone you care for is dying, you can feel the emptiness of losing him even before he's gone. I had no idea how many ways grief could rob you before it gave you something back. Sometimes I imagine myself a ghost, like the ghostly figures woven into the carpeting of the Royalton Hotel in Manhattan, where the artist Alain Moreau established her provisional encampment that June of 1996. If I'd had the talent of ghosts to haunt lobbies and hallways, to drift freely across oceans and eavesdrop on lives more definite than my own, I could have spied Alain a few days before I came to meet her at that hotel, when, as she would later recount to me in frank detail, she was still waiting on the sofa in the office of Manfred Zeffler in Schnell, Germany, world headquarters of the automaker AG. Ghosts are close. They observe things. How glumly Hélène lifted the mug of coffee Zeffler had set in front of her. I can picture Zeffler's manicured hands tapping his phone as he told Hélène he wished she had called his office first, how he could have saved her a flight from Paris. These are what we have. He stooped awkwardly at his desk to read to her from a few sheets of paper, as if those thin pages could have relieved Hélène's obvious sadness. The car purchased by a Mr. Alto Bianco in Rome was ordered on the 9th of October, 1953, chassis number 39212, Alto Bianco. And the color? Alain interrupted in German, ignoring Zeffler's neutral choice of English in addressing her. He consulted the records and replied in his native tongue, they called it egg cream custard. What about the interior? Was it red? Scarlet leather, yes. He handed her the page to see for herself. Do you, her lips were quivering. I don't think this helps me. I thought you might have something else. Of course. With a sigh of futility, Zeffler consulted the second sheet of paper. He glanced up. Hélène appeared to be lost in thought, resting the coffee mug against her cheek. Zeffler winced as she moved it to her lips. Emblazoned on her face was the lighthouse emblem of the Beacon Motor Company, the perfect reverse of the logo molded onto the side of the mug. Was she branding her cheek on purpose? He must have sensed she was not the type of collector who would be satisfied with anything as easy to locate as some substitute model. No. The drop-ins tended to be fixated on tracking down one particular vehicle, its chassis stamped with an identifying number as unique as a human fingerprint. Ambushed by Hélène's pleading gaze, Zeffler was like a postman whose customer was begging him to open the mailbox so she could unmail an envelope. A love letter posted too hastily, perhaps. They always wanted something back, something disguised in the shape of an automobile, a memory or a person they knew, a way of life they once had or never had and still coveted. He offered the remaining sheets of paper to Hélène for her inspection. But where is the car now? She asked, blinking wildly. That information is not in our current database. But I've come all this way. I'm afraid we have no ability to locate the current owner, Zeffler said. Are you aware that our new Beacon Heritage Museum has recently opened to the public? There are some fine examples of the Type 135 Roadster on display. He reached for the employee map on his desk. It's just here. Inside the tiny, well-ordered Beacon Museum, proceeding from one wall text to the next like the Stations of the Cross, she encountered among the polished bits of chrome and glass the first motor car to bear the lighthouse badge. On a wall nearby, a painted portrait of the company's founder, the late George M. Beacon, in middle age. An earnest-looking man with the resolute stance of a wrestler. That boy, what was it about the child in the photograph? No more than 7 or 8 years old, he was seated with Mr. Beacon in one of the company's models, not smiling, not posing in any way. At George Beacon's side, the boy was concentrating with great intensity on what was being said. Even the ends of his hair appeared to be standing to attention. The boy wasn't aware of the camera, only the direction in which the older man was pointing, forward to some unseen splendor. It was the last image on display in the museum. Still meditating on the photograph, impressed by the bravery she detected in the boy's face, Hélène heard her name and turned to find Manfred Zeffler striding through the exhibits, the panels of his suit jacket flapping like pinstriped wings. In his fingers, he held another sheet of paper. Well, I found something for you. With a flurry of words, not in the database, had to search the files, take my own time to photocopy, he explained that someone in his office had corresponded with the current owner of Beacon chassis number 39212. purchased the previous June at auction through Bonhams. He could offer her no further information, but he was pleased to provide her with a copy of the public auction record. It listed my employer, Emerson Tang Webster, who at that moment was drifting into a morphine dream in his loft in Greenwich Village, four blocks from the private garage on Perry Street, where he stored the same magnificent machine. And so it started, the race for a car and an engine that ended in a collision, not of vehicles, but of fates. Emerson's, mine, Hélène Moreau's, the boys in the photograph. Our stories collided so forcefully that they cannot be pried apart. We're like an ambiguous figure, a trick image with multiple parts. You might see, for example, the silhouette of a chalice in the center of the page, but when you shift your gaze to the edges of the frame, another image is revealed of a man and a woman facing one another. Their profiles form the outline of the cup, suspended between them, as if to seal a solemn pact they've made. Whether you notice the man and the woman or the cup, they're all part of the same picture. And more than that, the shape of one is determined by the others. I can illustrate with a second example using a paintbrush of Hélène Moreau's that ended up in my possession. Here's what appears to be an old woman. She's troubled by some memory or sorrow, her chin sunk into her chest. But look again, and you may also detect the outline of a younger woman there to the side. The girl is turned away, shy, unwilling to show herself fully. Both figures are present. They're composed of the same lines. What you perceive is a matter of how you read them. It's the same with the lines here, composed of letters and words, running along page after page, connecting one event to the next. In the end, it's impossible for them to reveal the shape of Emerson's afterlife without revealing my own, or the fate of Hélène Moreau, or the boy in the photograph, who was a grown man by the time she went off in search of the old car. Our stories cannot be separated any more than they can be separated from one final image I must not neglect to share here at the outset. Look, and you may detect, peeking through the lines, the disquieting face of an Asian woman. At first, you can just make out the slight curves of her forehead and nose, her cheeks, smooth, but for the scar on one side where she fell to the ground from exhaustion. Here are her eyes fixed in a hopeful stare, eager to take in their share of wonders, and the red bow of her lips sealed, like her fate, by famine. She is part of the picture as well. The car brought us together, but it was grief that joined us, really. Because this talk is called Poetic Principles, I thought you all might appreciate one of the principles I used in writing this book. It came from Gestalt psychology. A lot of the book is concerned with the modernist era in various ways, architecture, writing, design, etc. And it's where the car came into its own. In fact, it shaped the modern era. Gestalt psychology was concerned in part with the question of how the brain perceives inputs. Sometimes the same perceptual input can lead to very different interpretations or representations, as you could see from those pictures. And what they came to understand was that the brain is not passively accepting meaning, it's involved in making meaning. And so in terms of poetics, I was trying to indicate in a way how to read this book, because you can read it several different ways, depending on which character's storyline you follow, or how you even read an individual line. There was an intention on my part to build some depth or some levels into the book in that respect. And so it doesn't require any special reading. You can certainly read the book from a plot perspective, but people who have sensibilities trained in poetry, I think, would take very naturally to that type of reading. It is not really about tricks or a puzzle, it's just more of a, maybe a treasure hunt for those who want to try to read the book for a little bit more depth in the plot. The second passage I want to read, I want to set up again a little bit, because it refers to how Emerson and Beth became bonded originally, the narrator of the book and the title character. In this book, when I refer to an afterlife, I wasn't really talking so much about what happens to you after you die. I was really thinking more about the people who are left behind. Usually people are grieving in some way, and grief has strange effects on all of us. We carry forward parts of people in our own lives after they're gone, and sometimes in very profound ways. And so in this book, I was really looking at what is left of you in other people after you're gone, especially Emerson, because he affects all these characters, and our responsibilities to one another, not just personally, but even at a societal level. So a lot of the book has to do with trust and the meaning of trusts, like wills and trusts, and also archiving, because the narrator is an archivist, and she's very concerned with what are we saving from the past, what are we going to need in the future. And it's part of what we have to decide as a society, and I pulled Cars in that way. That was my way of trying to reflect on some of that at the end of the century. The last thing I want to say before I read this final piece is I did a bit of an experiment in the writing. Generally, writers are not advised to kill off their main character. Not a good idea. Usually before the end of the book, it can be seen as problematic. It's not something you would want to do, but in this case it was by design, so this is another point of poetics. I wanted to demonstrate that the main character, Beth, really merges her identity through grief with the man she's been taking care of. And so, in my mind, this character is actually still alive till the end of the book. He's alive in the form of Beth Corvid, the narrator. There's a point in the book where their identities merge, and she carries on. It's her skin. But essentially, she's living his life, and she has to find her own. So in this five-minute scene where I'm going to end tonight, it's just a few pages. Beth first encounters Emerson driving a car, and it's set in their hometown. They grew up in the same town as teenagers, although they didn't know each other very well. It's many years before his illness has taken hold. And it's here that she begins to form this very strong, empathic connection to him that carries through into their later years when she eventually assists him at the end of his life. And this is a flashback scene. She's in a nail salon, and someone is massaging her back. It triggers this memory. The hands slapped at my shoulders and arms, out of control. A windmill of frustrated swipes, so fierce it took my mother leaning over the back seat to fend them off. "He said he'd trade me," my brother cried. "That's not your sister's fault, Garrett. Don't take it out on her." Nothing could console my brother, falling away from me into the backseat of my parents' car. It must have been the early 1970s. At a birthday party for a boy named Nathan Sterling, my brother had been determined to trade a scratched-up car from his Matchbox collection, a Triumph Spitfire, for one of Emerson's scale models, a golden Maserati Ghibli, as Garrett would continue to remind us bitterly for years. It was to be their second trade, at Emerson's insistence, after my brother complained to anyone who would listen that he'd been fleeced on the first round of trading. Yet in place of vengeance or satisfaction of any kind, Garrett was fastening the tiny hood of his Triumph closed with an orthodontic rubber band and crying because Emerson never showed up. When school started in the fall, we found out Emerson's father had moved him to a private school in Greenwich, an offense for which my brother never forgave him. Stories about Emerson drifted back to us now and then, how the house on Gray Hill was visited by a world-class pianist following his performances at Carnegie Hall, not to give Emerson lessons, but to play private concerts to foster the boy's appreciation of the arts, or how, when Emerson turned 13, Mr. Webster sponsored a school field trip to the Museum of Modern Art. The class was taken afterward to a gallery on 57th Street, where each student was invited to choose a lithograph to take home, courtesy of Mr. Webster, who had hoped to start the youngsters off as collectors, or at least appreciators, in his son's name. I was a teenager by the time I saw Emerson again, inside a pizza place in Burringport Village. I recognized him immediately, distracted as I was, trying to pick out songs on a jukebox that had all the song titles written indecipherably in ballpoint pen. He pivoted in just long enough to pick up his food order, long enough for me to register his ripped jeans and sweatshirt, his black hair arranged in a mohawk, except for a shaggy waterfall over his eyes where the tips were bleached orange. By then, he'd started driving an old sports car around the course on his father's property. My brother called it a speedster. Garrett and his friends were jealous to the point of violence, not so much because the car was Porsche, but because Emerson had a private track to practice on a full year before any of them qualified for a learner's permit. Emerson passed me in the car one afternoon that winter, though I didn't see him so much as hear him. I was by myself on my way home from the library for dinner, loitering along the Sound with my parka hood pulled up, when a muffled buzz came vibrating through the fabric. All at once, the noise cut off. I pulled off my hood to listen, and for a few moments, the air was filled with nothing but steel cries, as loud and raucous as the engine had been. There was no sound of a crash, and I hesitated before I left the beach road and stepped onto the Webster's property, peering through the trees for a glimpse of Emerson or the car as I climbed further into the woods. What I came upon long after was a sight I cannot forget. At first, I had trouble making out the driver as I was still at some distance. There was no road leading to the place where he was parked. The car had been driven straight through the woods to the top of a rise, cutting deep ruts around the trees and through a carpet of rotted leaves. There was nothing around but bare trees, melting snow, and parts of some stone walls once erected as boundary markers. No people, no buildings. But it was empty in an expectant way, like the stage of an outdoor amphitheater that had yet to be populated with sets and costumes. Only an audience of crows, cawing in their mournful way overhead, waiting for the show to begin. When I looked back at Emerson, I could see it had already begun. He was the actor in a private scene that I sensed I should have turned away from, but couldn't. I was riveted by the strangeness of what I saw. He was seated alone in the open-topped car, stopped alongside a pile of rocks, his hair covered by a knitted cap and his neck hinged back at an angle so extreme that until that day I had seen the gesture only in paintings of carnage. His eyes were closed and his mouth was stretched open, but there was no sound coming out. I thought he was laughing to himself, so overcome by a hilarious thought that he'd had to stop the car. Then I thought he was in a state of ecstasy, about to reach the climax of some motorized jerk-off session. I started to turn away when all at once his shoulders heaved, and I recognized that his posture had nothing to do with pleasure. He was wailing, silently, his face to the sky running with tears. His body began to shake. He raised his hands, fitted with racing gloves, but instead of wiping his face, he reached out and gripped the windscreen. His arms shook as if he was trying to tear it off the car. And then all at once his body sagged, with his arms hanging there. He bowed his head in surrender to some unknown mystery. An odd sensation came over me. It was as if I could feel the force of his suffering. His pain was unknowable to me, though I seemed to taste it then. I feared that he was physically hurt, that he'd hit something after all. What were all those loose stones around the car? He could have a wound or an injury I couldn't see. Without thinking, I hurtled up the hill, kicking through frozen leaves, but within seconds, the engine started up, and abruptly, he was in retreat. I stood listening until I couldn't hear the sound anymore, a roaring mechanical chord that rose and fell like a wave through the woods and out to the graffiti-scarred lighthouse at the end of the point. Thank you.
Hi, everyone, and thank you for being here. I apologize, I'm gonna read off a laptop. I don't normally like to do that, but it's really new work, and I'm right in the middle of moving back to Richmond. So I couldn't print it off before I got here. So instead of reading from Signaletics tonight, I thought I would read from some new work that's in the second manuscript I'm finalizing right now called Ground Speed. And the two latest additions to the manuscript are two pieces that I'm calling essays and poems. So I'm feeling sort of unsure about what their genre exactly is. It is lineated, but it's a little bit longer. It should take me about 12 minutes to read it. And I thought I would just dive right in after thanking Mary Flynn for having me here in New Virginia Review, also the Library of Virginia, and Josh and Paula for reading too. Thank you. All right, this is called No Man's Land. You might notice some Richmond landmarks here. One, whenever the sleepwalkers at dawn finally stumble into their rooms or slump over the steering wheels of their hubcapless Impalas, the seagulls land and become a landscape over a landscape, as snow does, a contour line of the Budget Inn on the corner of North Lombardy and Brook, Richmond's north side. When the flock lifts, it lifts at once, proportional to its placement across the steep roof, the cars and open lot. So it seems that something essential, even soul-like, rises from the motel, the way in movies a ghost flickers over a body at the moment of death, superimposed blue, see-through and shining, confused, maybe even smiling, until it looks around and sees itself or who it was there on the ground. Two. I dreamed I wandered lost in a city, and only a lace nightgown, a blanket over my shoulders. I'd escaped a high-rise hotel after an elevator crashed into the basement. A column of fire rising and lashing through the steel doors on the top floor, the stairs blocked by avalanche. I don't remember how I got out, and therefore wasn't sure I had. Was I a ghost, a projection? I came to on a sidewalk in a deserted part of town, the buildings boarded up, the garbage in heaps on the curb uncollected, without knowing where I was or where I was going. But then I found my car double parked, running, the key in the ignition. 3. Frank Zappa wanted to buy up billboards along the Eisenhower Interstate system and plaster them with two words, doubt everything. 4. Two sons, one in the rear view, one in the side mirror. The meter money rattles in the door to the bass drum on Feist the Bad and each other. As I turn a corner, my shadow laps me. I drive from Richmond to Raleigh, Raleigh to Fredericksburg to Gettysburg on pre-interstate highways in 2 days. I keep my notebook open on my lap to write down the names of motels I pass, partly because they've devolved from the technicolor-esque postcard destinations with mod geometric signs to roadside slumps of peeling paint and mediocre marquee promises, housing stereotypes and imagined meth dens. And I admit, I love ruin. And therefore, seeing them, a quarter plunks into the vending machine of my heart and down drops a bag of generic American nostalgia. Here's some of those hotels. Royal Inn, waterbeds. Crescent Motel, clean room, HBO. 360 Motel. Cardinal Motor Court, travelers welcome, micro fridge. Johnson's Lodge, vacancy, single double, color TV. And partly because they seem to stand in for my late anxieties become totem, unrest, excess, anonymity. 6. Driving from Gettysburg to pick up a friend at the Baltimore Amtrak, I listened to a Hopkins radio segment on the link between sleep cycles and depression. A neurologist advised listeners one can improve emotional health by turning off the television and computer at least 2 hours before bed, as electronic screens emit a blue light whose rapid frequency fools the body circadian into thinking it's a brighter time of day and therefore prevents deep sleep. 7. One summer at age 10 or 11, I couldn't sleep and so watched the full run of Nick at Night for weeks, Lucy at 9 to Mr. Wizard at 5. Sucking on Mayfield banana popsicles and chipping away at Rita's Italian ices with a tongue depressor, crawling beneath the uncurtained back windows from the den to the kitchen so no one, no intruder surely there, could see me. My mother, severely depressed, slept all night with a hairdryer on to drown out noise, holding it like a drowsy cowboy on watch with his gun. I was terrified of fire, and so I stayed awake, for when I closed my eyes, I saw her shadow moving down the hall, like I am now, at 3 a.m, startled vertical by the burn of coffee in the pot of the house of someone else who's letting me stay here. 8. The insomniac speaker of Larkin's Obad is terrorized by this thought. The sure extinction that we will travel to and shall be lost in always, not to be here, not to be anywhere, and soon, nothing more terrible, nothing more true. 9. When dark times loom, we say night is coming. Whenever I have hope, I say, I see the light at the end of the tunnel. Both are also used as metaphors for death. 10. Once a black bag was wheeled out of the Budget Inn. Police tape cracked like a whip in the wind. Another time, another day at the red light, I look through an open door, second from the end, inside a shirtless man with a Manson-esque beard and hair, dancing in front of the television, rabbit-eared to the news. 11. Get your daily exercise. Run away from Satan. Graveyards are full of good intentions. Example is a language anyone can read. 12. My mother tells the story of the father of my first best friend, the preacher at the Grace Reformed Baptist Church down the street, who asked me, age 4, if I died that day, where would I go, heaven or hell? I answer again and again in the repeating, my mom doesn't let me go places like that by myself. She was boring. 13. Miscellaneous road signs and the line breaks are original as in the others. Lose 3 pounds a day, $30 magic. Magic touch, all girl staff. Flying circus, airport. American ex-prisoners of war highway. 14. On an unsalted stretch, bested by ice, I submit to $51 a night and color television at the Boston Inn in Westminster, Maryland, the only place open. The incandescent light reviving a moth's orbit that had stilled in the darkness preceding my artless entrance on the chain gang of shadows, anxious and shaking, my pack slumped on the chair, the odor fecal of cigarettes. My mind wonders whose knees were burned on the geometric carpet. A hole melted into the bedspread's vanitas of flowers, the deadbolt latches with the door frame's busted gold chain fin as a necklace. My tired tread is caked in snow. On the lobby RCA, a football game in whiteout conditions, in the snowy reception of antennas where we lose the players in a huddle. Entering this room, I enter a room inside myself, with four corners and a human form crouched in the shadow where the bed goes, the bathroom light falling on me. I catch my reflection in the mirror. I want to hear the form speak to me, my own voice echoing off the tile or the neighbor's headboard before I leave with a refund. But as I recall, absence can only be heard by dogs. 15. Weeks apart, I drive past two abandoned churches, a one room wooden with peeling white and copper green paint, broken glass windows on Mount Olive Lane off Patrick Henry Highway. In addition to the no trespassing signs, a little one, future home of the wedding chapel. The others outside, Bicklerville, Pennsylvania. I barely got a look at it, except its yellowed marquee, New Hope Church. 16. It is better to live in a state of impermanence than in one of finality. Bachelard. 17. Which is why it is better to live in language rather than out of language. 18. I fantasize about inventing a downloadable voice setting for GPS called Virgil Trademark, who might provide us with more insightful directions. Example. If a mile is a distance you value, then in its time turn, but against that orphan arc of going from point to point to point, everywhere is a direct object, and you will arrive in the middle of your life, but leave everywhere I guide you, we hope. 19. Vibrating bed, shag carpet, black light forensics, a waffle press at the continental breakfast, candy bars in the mini fridge with the little jack. Motel is a portmanteau of motor and hotel. So many of the old tourist motels outside Gettysburg National Park are now low-income apartments. One has a vending machine that's the only light for about a mile on old Harrisburg Highway. Cemeteries as transient spaces. Demini mobile homes leave their lots. The preacher, I remember, had a waterbed. Was it to be more like Noah? 20. Before my mother married him, my stepfather lived in the extended stay America. We would bring over beef tips and baked potatoes from Steakout and eat them out of to-go styrofoam, Law and Order on the television. 21. We're always leaving words, our most transient dwellings. Unlike motel rooms where I've left clothes, one shoe or a sock, a cell phone, its charger, my husband's car keys, where the maids use gloves to throw away unmentionables and to pull hair from drains, we seldom leave something of ourselves, something that we own inside of a word. We seldom change it, although words change through misuse or genius. But a word might change us, our landscapes, our movements, how we see our country, literally and figuratively, as if by traveling on the interstate, we might actually move between states of being. I pass an empty field bordered by trees, a tattered billboard in its center, future home of the fountain of life. But I would close with one poem called The Ghost of Patsy Cline Hitches a Ride. I hear that Brad Hefford loves Patsy Cline too, so this goes to Brad. Wandering as long as I've been, it's like I haven't had enough clothes on. And so I've been holding myself to keep warm, but my hands are cold. Or it's more like I can't feel them in the here and now, but that I yearn for them so much, their absence has the same weight and heat as my hands did before. You wouldn't believe how much the wind cuts through me now. You want me to say I need a man to warm me up, I know, but I don't need anything now, and I need everything. You'll understand one day, don't we all? When we die, we realize our great unrequited love was ourselves. When your headlights moved into me, I felt as if I had a body again, the way a teardrop on the crystal chandelier in the end-all, be-all fills the whole room through the light it breaks and scatters into the shadows. Thank you.
Hi there. Thanks so much to the library and for Mary for kind of mushing us into the reading. Paula and I kind of conned our way into it, possibly. So thank you very much. It's very sweet. I have a stopwatch. I'm not good at preparing for reading, so I bring a lot of stuff, and I hope that by the end of it, I will have stopped at a correct moment, which is kind of rude in a way, but I don't think anyone cares. I thought I would officially start now, and I'm going to read a very old poem that involves Paula in a way that, this is like grad school old. I've known Paula since 1994, so that's like 20 years now. I remember sitting on your front porch on Lombardi, your apartment, and I gave you like a version of this poem to read, and you were like, I think those first two lines are Michael Ondaatje's, aren't they? And I was like, no. I got them from Fellini. They're from AmeriCorps. They're translated. And she was like, no. And you went upstairs and got the book. So you thought I was trying to pull one over, I guess. And they were there. But the difference is that Ondaatje didn't say they were from Fellini.
And you did.
Yeah, I did. So they're in here at the very end to make it official. So this is very old, but it's in honor of Paula. It's called The Nostalgia of the Finite. Remember those women in the movies who wept into the hair of their dead men, the crumbled red walls of their voices shored on a riverbank? I was young then, and to remember the glow of willows above the women, the snails under their feet, the mule hobbled and fly-bitten, is to remember what slips away. Well, at least I'll try to remember. It's important not to neglect such things. The weeping, yes, that's important. But what comes after the weeping and the birch bark love letters is a white screen of fog, the mule asleep in the rain. Sometimes the men would keep their eyes open so the women could see that it wasn't that hard to drown, to show them that to have seen the bottom of a river is to have seen the end, what the living call light or silence or the village with its dark and blue roofs. Sometimes the women would look at the men, bundles of frozen reeds, and remember what it was like to walk together through the cut fields of wheat beyond the village, to drink from the same jar, to sleep and know that under the morning's eaves,
All women are one woman, all men one man. The dark theater, an usher waking you, the end so plainly there, it hurts just to see it. This is from my first book. This is a discarded copy that I got on eBay for $1.50 from the Daniel Boone Regional Library. So do not give Daniel Boone Regional Library any of your business. I put googly eyes on the front of it just to make it photo op. Just to make it even worse for me, I guess. Here I'll read some newer-ish poems from my third manuscript. It's called The Regret Histories. And I guess I fetishize things. Like in the first book, it was like dead birds and my dead father. The second book was, I guess, the dead 19th century. And this one is just the regret all the way. Regret and sadness. I don't know. I was going to read some happy poems. I don't know if I have any. That's kind of sad. I really should look into that. That's a problem. This one is called Death of the Death of Youth. And it includes a lot of Dylan Thomas lines here and there, which you probably can tell because they're better than the other lines. I see the summer children and their mothers and the way that the womb chose them to live, fingers veined into the alley oaks, night burst their throats, no signal moon. The power out again, I listen for a whistle or car horn, something I might know in all that dark. Now the kids are in the street, graphing new homes with their voices, a living sound, a wound of air I do not understand. Their hands knead the asphalt. One throws half a brick, and the blood that arrives unseen is no one's. The noise of time is not sad. It's diagrammed somewhere inside the land. We honor this emptiness. A door appears, a flame. A girl at the end of the block lights a cigarette. Her face assembled from radiance and the acres. The loneliness of her, of me watching her, the nothingness of me, of this room, the receding storm pinioned to the sky. In 1875, a shipbuilder built this house to carve his name on an attic beam, laudanum sweat through the plaster. The regret of his name there, as if it could conceive, then hurt. The regret history assembles by the highway, the projects, the cemetery, all stacked up, dissected, is not hungry. Walter forecloses next door, and mold rises through the sheriff's arms. Cloves spread on the sidewalk for the rats to tame and sweeten. Everyone has a flashlight, a gun. Who kills my history, the kids should yell, spoons carving the sides of cars. I am the man your father was, I think. We are the sons of flint and pitch. I do not exist for us. The past has failed into shapes, as if light gathered form from the air and gave to it a body, the weeds bowing in every direction, in mercy and indifference. I've also had a problem with telling the truth in poems. You don't have to tell the truth all the time. So I think I avoided that for a long time, and I think these are more closer to my life and just about living in Churchill and Richmond. I don't think I mentioned any specific landmarks. And the weird thing, like I started writing these poems maybe like 6 or 7 years ago, and about Churchill, everything has changed now. Like, I'm losing my authentic vibe because of all the whiteies moving into the neighborhood, including me. Like, you know, I have like gunshots in here and finding syringes. And now I find like chicken wings from the Roosevelt because people can't stop eating when they're leaving. They're eating and eating and eating because it's so good. That's what I get now. So I guess it's a way of archiving a neighborhood that's changing. I don't know. This one is called Drug Department. And it starts with my friend Suzanne Kokel's line from her novel Mirabilis, and she just got married this weekend, too. So this is for her. I'm looking for a story that will light my way out, a star in the sycamore's grass, taken from night and nothing, and limbs cut back from the wires. It is not summer. There's no mist on the streets. The yard, vacant with ivy and nest, wears brown and the streetlights. The sycamore is the loudest tree, its bark lifting the hard wind like the saint who prayed to the east and failed. Parchment spread on the monastery roof, help me, spelled out in supplicant ink, roaring through clots of frost. Look at us, late winter, pulling dead branches from the fence at night to avoid the neighbors. Poison pushed under the shed for the rats. Let's surrender all illusions of spirit, because it deceives us. The spirit is not air, even in its highest form, no matter who sparks the flame. Tonight I will suffer from not knowing how to suffer. Tomorrow will be the same. There used to be pills to cure this affliction. Early decay, feebleness of will, wonderful little liver pills, beef, iron, and wine for the poorest blood, for fever of the known and unknown world. The sycamore leans its branches on the telephone lines, to hear them on the phone, those manuscripts of bark, breathing the wires, does nothing for my courage. This is how you become a saint, translate the ruins wherever they sleep, bloom the tulip tree early and watch bees gather in the sleet. There is no abyss, no oblivion ocean, just a landscape like this one, born from a river and seven hills, bone under the hospital cobbles, ghost rope taut in the gallows. The glad bees orphan their hive, too soon and unwise. It isn't death I want, but it isn't life either. So I've been working on this thing, actually with Blackbird, with Joe Woods. It's not a collaboration, really. It's like I wrote something, and then he takes it and does amazing things to it. So I don't really do much. But we're working on this kind of interactive thing, I guess, where I take like an aerial photograph of my childhood, the land where I grew up, and I'm marking little spots, and I'm writing about each one. And I'm hoping, like, when you click on those little numbers and symbols, that text will pop up, and everyone will be impressed, and I will be carried on the backs of people outside of the stadium, and roars will appear, and lions, and I don't think it's going to work that way. But I'm really excited to work on this, and it's part autobiography, but it's also a meditation on land, and I think I'll read the more meditative sections rather than the autobiographical ones, just a few of them. And I don't even know if it has a title. Here it says, and I quote, Department of Aerial Photography. I think I've also called it like Dead Map and Death Map, like really metal things. Here's a few sections. The first memento mori was the land, clots of sea sown from the horizon, the amoeba with a microscope and a shovel finding its way through the burn district. It's enough of a reminder to see it from up here. In the fields, there's a death clock shaped from sweet potato mounds, and the face is not looking toward us, but inward, deep in the frost of 10,000 feet. If every photograph is a catastrophe that has already occurred, as Barth says, and every camera is a clock for seeing, I measure my life through the intervals of landscape, what lasts, what still moves, disintegration loop of two foxes at dawn, always two foxes, always the oak. The government plane documents the land, and through this we remain. Borges, say it louder this time. We forget that we are all dead men conversing with dead men. Persimmons on the dirt road, fire ants expand and rise through the hurt they bring. Part of me disappeared in the blackberry. If I have a spirit, it will walk the vines, blood beads along its wrist. I write this as souvenir, bottling the landscape's inability to reconcile, to endure our constant need to translate what is no longer. I am the witness in animal clothes, frustrated by the failure of the afterlife, grotesque at the tobacco field's edge. There is no century to pull apart. The sweet gum tree drops its little children into my father's truck bed, giving up all allegiance to the coming frost. I did not see God in the trees. What leaves there were pulled from the light a burdensome figure, Vaseline jar stored in the dead pine, a biscuit in each hand for the pigs flooding the field, all slot-mouthed and breaching. The work of memory collapses time, Benjamin said, but this isn't time I'm talking about. It's translating water, the little fish I called aspirin eye, silver and white and alive in the creek. Landscape was nothing more than a burden, a poor name for the earth that was already mine. That one gets pretty long, so that's a good idea to stop there, I think. I think I'll read this one longer piece. It's called Letter to Gabriel, written in the margins of murder ballads. So it is addressed to Gabriel, the enslaved man who in 1800 attempted a rebellion in Richmond, and it was thwarted and failed, and he and between 25 and 28 other of his conspirators were hanged, I guess, six blocks from here, and they're possibly buried in that same area. So this is for him, written to him, but I addressed my friend Jake Adam York in this, who died a little over a year and a half ago. And he was kind of a big influence on me. He's such a great guy, so very sweet. And so it's for him, it's for Gabriel. I mentioned people from the neighborhood where I live, this woman Woo Woo, who I haven't seen in a long time. This guy, old timer Harry down the street, he's always working on his cars. So these names will kind of pop up here and there. And I won't read the whole thing. I already cut some things out. So this is for Gabriel and Jake, and the title, Letter to Gabriel, Written in the Margins of Murder Ballads. Murder Ballads is Jake's first book. So there's an epigraph from Gary Lutz, a really wonderful fiction writer. Here's a story in the worst way. I have no business being anywhere in it. It comes between me and the life I have coming. Blood of my abyss, a legible voice, was the morning kind. The cold dawns here steaming through. I imagine you in a field across the river, floodplain attic, lichen brailed thin on the pump house door. You are dead in the gallows and not dead. The rope cannot claim you. It is another century. Things are not better or worse. You came without a horse and left us human hair in the tulip tree, strange among the blossoms. For years we weren't terrified. We carried around your death, its severity. The terror lasts, your grave a wide field now, but I never thought of it as something separate. Jake gone 6 months, then seven. I moved through summer, verb for breath, a crew. Heat understands, folds into the dashboards. A woman is living in her Oldsmobile on Lee Street. For weeks she unfolds the traffic. The shade of an elm pours, devalues, all present tense and bending close, house to house. There is no explaining the ghost of a face, then a face. What can I give that won't be taken, assembled into guilt? The feral cat under the shed archives the rats, then squirrels. Gone isn't the word I'm looking for. There's no other way to say it. I was built by slaves, carved skin white pine like sand and tobacco, and the poteet name that pulls me from you. Say the words the fields would speak. The bloodline stops here. All the sleeping poteets, all their skin impossible to see, all their land in gauzed light, all the asphalt and rain between us, all the kerosene on the carpet, kudzu weaving doors shut, all great-great-grandfathers gutting pigs, all great-grandmothers throwing sand on the blood, all industry siphoned, all selves creek-banked, collapsed, all plantations a coffin, a little vandalism, the whole family haunted. I've played the slave narratives in abandoned places, among the candles and cinder blocks, silo dirt, house where the vultures live, all to bring you back. There's a shopping mall where your anvil stood. I bought socks, a button-down shirt, and sat in the parking lot listening to the corroded wax cylinders, disintegrating dialects, becoming a column of air anyone can pass through. I never deserved to hear them. Woo Woo turned a trick in the rent-a-toilet last night. I watched her pull the man in, septic dark pocked with paper towels, clefts of rain. The world was one place, then overnight it became someplace else. In other words, this is always going to be about mine, not yours. I am teaching myself to see the street as sleep is seen. Woo Woo with a toothache, jaw looped with pantyhose, even mentioning her as a gentrification. I make it sound like I know an answer. She is not you, and we honor this emptiness. When the highway came, the houses didn't know enough to be afraid. Leeway and ease, night comes through the gutters loose as fever. I don't believe there is an answer, honeysuckle blooming the creek gut. There are tunnels leading up from the river, dug before the war. Torch ends grating in their cups, history averting into the cellars of abolitionists. This is not what I mean to say to you. Jake, gone 8 months, even the sunny huckle estranges. Pleats the afternoon. Everything is unfinished, momentary. It's not anyone's fault, I know. We're all strangers to the middle of the noise. On Live at Birdland, Coltrane's Alabama drops the snare by the church parking lot at 2:42. That's where the ghosts are, waiting with the floor tom, a tousled mess of glyph and syllable. Child of gravity, stranger to the ground, come down and help me rise. The jessamine cut back, the wisteria ordered and blunt from the rails. We have to be humble or we're taken down. How many examples do you need? Soft as milk-shaped light in the halfway house where the sex offenders live. An owl in another country invented night. You must remember this is not about history. It's about finding where life enters our death. I did not bring you to the river beneath the river, because time ruins a heresy. The river erases itself when we need it most. Dawn inside dawn, tar in the throat of the oak. A hermit thrust strange and metallic over Jefferson Park repeats the vowels its body carves, a fine ash of song too far south. A house is taken from the landscape, and the wind blows stronger through that space. The body can't signify that kind of vacancy. Jake, gone almost a year. Woo Woo, gone. Feral cat, gone. Harry's down the street fixing his station wagon in the cold. He said the cops used my house in the 80s to watch the dealers on the corner. The whole block abandoned back then. Sniper in the bay window, dead man on the bricks, 19 arrested. The black stain on the bedroom floor refutes the belt sander, shifts from history to history, outliving us, passing deeper. Stanley's drunk again, his walk more song than speech. He asked me once if I was rich. The porch fell off Scott's house and made the news. Someone's burning wood this evening, the Masonic Lodge quiet. I leaned from the window to feel it slip past me. Forfeit the dead grass, the rim of dandelion and mortgage. Forfeit the factory where their marrow is pulled. Forfeit taxonomy, the legalese of the law office windows at sunset. So many heretofores and to wits. Forfeit foreclosure, the vacant lots, stairs leading to white grass and sunlight, where houses were sewn together, now gone. The old theater on 25th Street, sunk in ivy, the roof long gone, or the roof is the sky. Either way, there's nothing there. Saplings crowd the orchestra pit, mud wasps in the projection booth, flicker of pornography and sun hollowing the years. I've never been hungry. You invented hunger and handed it to the owl. 200-year-old crime scene tape slung from the bridges. What should the new map look like? Help me, moonlight. Bring the granary to the sky. Burnt yellow called down. The night that took you will take us too. That's all. Thank you so much.
Thank you all for coming and listening to such good work. Please buy books. And thank you again to the Library of Virginia for letting us bring our dog and pony show over here from time to time. Thank you, Jan. And hopefully we'll be doing some readings next fall. Yeah.